Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
This happens nowhere else other than the United States of America. This epidemic of mass slaughter.
Senator Chris Murphy joins us on violence and the origins of America's gun obsession. Then,
I was afraid every single day.
She's the accidental leader of Belarus, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, says people will no longer live under Europe's last dictator. Plus, environmental activist Erin Brockovich, immortalized on screen by Julia Roberts, says don't wait for Superman, it's all up to us. And
chess is a great equalizer because it doesn't matter where you come from or your ethnicity or background or how rich you are or poor you are, it's about the game.
Actor John Leguizamo helps underprivileged students say checkmate in his directorial debut, Critical Thinking. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The day after Labor Day, and it is the last furlong in the horse race known as the American election. Officially, it is beginning now. Less than 60 days out, the whole world has eyes on, and there is nothing normal about this one or about the state of play in America. From a pandemic to a recession to protests against racial injustice and violence. At the heart of this, guns. Something my first guest has spent a lot of time thinking about. Chris Murphy became a junior senator in Connecticut less than a month after the Sandy Hook School massacre in 2012. 26 people were killed, most of them children. And he says it changed his life forever, and he's become one of the country's most prominent, most ardent gun control advocates. In his new book, The Violence Inside Us, Murphy explores the history of America's gun fascination and where he sees a path to a less deadly tomorrow. And Chris Murphy joins me now from Washington. Senator, welcome to the program. You know, from reading the book, it's clear that you see a sort of violent gene that has impacted American history from the beginning. And it's extraordinary, actually, that it's coming out now as we see, to an extent, this playing out on the streets of the United States with an election, a determinative election, on the horizon. How does this play into what's going on right now, in your view?
Well, thanks for having me on the show. And yes, we are having a renewed reckoning with American violence. For much of the last 7 years, we've been talking about this issue predominantly through the prism of mass shootings. But now we are watching these horrific scenes of black men being shot in the back or killed by a police officer putting a knee on their neck. And this book, I hope, will provide some answers to people as to why America became this violent. For me, my exploration did start after that brutal murder, the massacre in Sandy Hook. And this book, in some ways, tries to tell the story of my education to the readers. And, you know, the conclusion I come to is that, yes, there is a genetic code inside all of us that means humans as a species are going to be predisposed towards violence. But then there's this unique history in the United States dating all the way back to the settlement of the country when we were massacring Native Americans through the period of enslavement to Jim Crow to today, where America has become numb to violence. Violence has been used since the very beginning in order to sort of reinforce a racial caste system. And while it's different today than it was when we had millions of Americans enslaved, still to this day, America has become anesthetized to violence in a way that few other nations are. And my book is a history of that violence, but then also a examination of the ways in which we can do better. It's a complicated story, which also means it's a complicated set of prescriptions. It's not just about changing gun laws. Mm-hmm. It's also about recognizing that if you don't change the economic order of this country, then you're not giving a lot of folks pathways to success other than violence.
Exactly. But let me ask you, you say Americans have become anesthetized. And maybe from my perspective, sitting over here across the ocean, I wonder whether it's something different, something that's just so internalized, as you say, because it's not just happened. Violence has been a vital tool of the American experiment, of what's called American exceptionalism, frankly. You mentioned Native Americans, slavery. I mean, this is inbred in your history. So do you actually see a day when violence, when America won't be such a violent place? I mean, has America even internalized what it's become?
Well, and my book is really a series of stories, and one of the early stories is the story of how American violence moves both up and down. In fact, American violence isn't heading in only one direction. American violence has waves. One wave in the Civil War era, another wave in the Tommy gun era of the 1920s, and then another wave in the 80s and 90s. But American violence comes down as quickly as it goes up. And in the last 100 years, the two moments at which American violence has declined at the most spectacular rates has been right after America passed the two biggest, most comprehensive firearms control acts of the last 100 years in 1936, 38, and then in 1993, 94. And that's not coincidental. When you control the means of violence, you can get a pretty big rate of return. And when you send a signal that America's highest leaders care about this epidemic, such that they are going to pass big, comprehensive, controversial legislation, that moral signal in and of itself has an impact. So, no, my book certainly tells the story of how American violence goes up, but it also tells the story of what we can do to force it down.
Okay, so that's really interesting, because you say, you know, in the publicity, you say that, you know, there'll be some surprise reveals. Well, perhaps one of them is that as a Democrat, you actually have concluded and you do believe that the Second Amendment extends to the private ownership of guns. Talk a little bit about then how that interpretation of the Constitution, which many, many have, how you can balance people's rights with necessary safety. In other words, how did those two periods that you talk about actually balance people's rights with a safety imperative?
No, I think this will be a bit surprising, because there are, you know, many progressives and many folks in the anti-gun violence movement that don't believe the Second Amendment protects the private right of gun ownership. And that's a really plausible argument, because if you read a lot of the history around the drafting of the Second Amendment, it does seem to be mostly about making sure that we can have reliable militia service. But my broader read and examination of our constitutional history tells me that our founders probably did believe in a common law right to gun ownership. But what's also interesting is that during the drafting of the Constitution, America had a ton of gun regulation. We required you to register guns. We required you to register your ammunition. We had broad populations that weren't allowed to own guns. And so from the very beginning, I think that there's been an understanding that, well, government can't broadly take away your right to own a firearm. Government can require you to register weapons. Government can say these people are too dangerous to have a weapon. And government can say these weapons are too dangerous for anybody to have. And so I think that's the sweet spot. And frankly, I think that's where like 70 to 80% of the American public are. So if Democrats just sort of got to the place where we acknowledge the right, but also government's right to control gun ownership, I think we'd be in a very good place.
So let me ask you, because, you know, Sandy Hook was something that shocked you as a new senator. It shocked the world. I mean, nobody could believe that it had got to the state where actually children could be deliberately targeted and mowed down. How did it affect you as a human being, as a parent?
Well, you know, this book is clearly not a Sandy Hook book, but it does talk about my experience and how it transformed me. You know, I'm pretty honest about, you know, some of the liabilities I thought I had as a political figure. I was pretty prodigious as a legislator, but I didn't really have an emotional connection to any of the issues that I was working on, and I do now. I feel a connection to those families, to those parents. They're all about my age. And I feel like if I don't deliver a piece of federal legislation that reduces the chances that a Sandy Hook ever happens again, then I'm a failure as a political servant. And that sort of emotional rooting is different today than the way in which I approached issues before Sandy Hook. My hope is that this book sort of invites people to go through a similar transformation, that equipped with all of this information about why America is violent and what we can do about it, that the reader can then become a more effective and more educated activist and become part of this movement that we're building that I think eventually will prevail.
So perhaps some of it you see on the streets. I mean, some of that movement started after the Parkland massacre. Now you see Black Lives Matter. That's all about not just protecting unarmed Black people who get killed, but also controlling the use of guns, so to speak, and that violence. You see that it's being used also as an election tool. But certainly President Trump is talking about being the law and order candidate, the person who can reduce violence. Tell me what's happening around this mega issue that we see, racial injustice, the use of weapons against unarmed Black people, and the use of it in an election campaign.
Well, the beginning of the book tells the story of the biology of violence, and it's an interesting story. I mean, it begins thousands of years ago. There's a piece of us inside that has been sort of built to fear those that are different from us, those that are in a different tribe. That's been part of American biology for thousands of years. And politicians, unfortunately, know that. And so for centuries, they have played upon this irrational fear of the other. And societies have often used violence in order to stoke those fears. That's what President Trump is doing today. He's creating this irrational fear of Mexican immigrants or Muslims or Black Americans in our cities. He is using violence as a mechanism to sort of trump up and play up this fear. I don't think he will ultimately be successful, but I think it's important for folks to understand that all these politicians that are trying to make you be scared of something different than you, somebody that looks different from you, somebody that practices a different religion from you, they are unfortunately tapping into something that is biological. And the more that we understand that, and so that we know what we have to do to overcome it, the better. And that's why the first chapter of this book is about the biology of violence.
You know, this awful cliche that television has used in the past, if it bleeds, it leads, whatever's violent gets, you know, so much coverage. A very, very important report that was released last week said that 93% of the protests against racial injustice happening on the streets of America right now have been peaceful. So I just want to ask you whether you think the American people are looking at violence, or are they looking at COVID, coronavirus, their daily safety and concerns and questions about that as a lead issue?
Well, I do think that if you ask the average American what percentage of these protests have been peaceful, they would not say 93%. And so I do think that there is this fear not based in reality about the nature of these protests. But I will also say I think that to the extent that people want investment in peaceful protest, then Joe Biden is that candidate. I think that he has done a great job of saying no matter who you support politically, there's no room for violence. That being said, I do think ultimately it is COVID and the healthcare crisis that's going to dominate the decisions people make about this election, as people still can't get back to work, as their kids are sort of coming back home after wearing masks for 6 to 7 hours at school. The candidate that has the most plausible path to getting us over the hump with respect to coronavirus is going to win this election. And right now, hands down, that is, of course, Joe Biden. Donald Trump is, in fact, primarily responsible for the 180,000 deaths we've had in the United States.
So let me ask you about another election issue that many people are very worried about. That is Russian interference. This is what Vice Presidential Candidate Kamala Harris told Dana Bash in an interview about this issue.
I am clear that Russia interfered in the election of president in the United States in 2016. I serve on the Senate Intelligence Committee. We have published detailed reports about exactly what we believe happened. And I do believe that there will be foreign interference in the 2020 election and that Russia will be at the front of the line.
Could it cost you the White House?
Theoretically, of course. Yes.
Do you worry about that at this point, Senator Murphy? And do you think that all these years later, the U.S. intelligence and all the people who need to be addressing this have done it sufficiently?
No, they haven't. They have not. I mean, President Trump has not taken this issue seriously. He had the chance to elevate it in his discussions with Vladimir Putin. He hasn't, and he hasn't likely for one reason. That is that he expects and hopes that the Russians will interfere again on his behalf. And what is so disturbing to me is that the intelligence services, who have already made clear the Russians are attempting to manipulate the 2020 election in order to elect Donald Trump, the intelligence services have very detailed information about who is acting on behalf of Russia, who are actually Russian agents that people are hearing about in the American political debate. And they have not released that information to the American public. I don't know why we spend billions of dollars on collecting intelligence about election interference if we're not prepared to tell the American public who's acting legitimately and who's acting on behalf of a foreign government. They better do that soon. Or others that have access to that information are going to have to do it ourselves.
I think I read between the lines of what you're saying there. But can I go back quickly to the subject of your book? Obviously, devil's advocate, it's the position of the NRA that, quote unquote, good guys with guns deter bad guys with guns. In other words, the more law-abiding citizens have guns, the less a criminal would have a gun and use a gun. You have actually said, if more guns led to less crime, America would be the safest place on earth. But having said that, my question to you is, the NRA, it's been so historically powerful, particularly in elections, particularly, you know, supporting candidates. But it's also facing a lot of backlash right now. Where do you think it stands and where does its future stand? You know, the New York Attorney General is potentially going to, take it to court.
Well, the NRA has never been weaker than it is today. It may be on its way to complete irrelevancy. This book does tell the story of the NRA. They used to be a pretty sleepy pro-gun control organization. The NRA wrote some of the nation's first state gun control laws in the 1920s. They got taken over in a putsch by radical hardline right-wingers in the 1970s who sort of wanted to unite the NRA with all of the emerging anti-government hierarchy and infrastructure inside the Republican Party. But they have sort of gotten way over their skis these days. They need to sort of feed this paranoia about government in order to drive more and more gun sales. But now, 90% of their own members, 85% of their own members support universal background checks. And so they have just lost relevancy because their positioning has become more and more extreme as more and more Americans actually get to the point where they say, hey, listen, we don't want to take away the right of gun ownership, but boy, we think these assault weapons should be off the streets. We think that everybody should have to go through a background check. They just look at the NRA and think to themselves, well, that's not an organization that's representing gun owners, because almost all the gun owners I know want everybody to go through a background check.
And everybody wants a safer America. Senator Chris Murphy, thank you for joining us. And we just mentioned how Russia is interfering even in this cycle of the U.S. elections, turning now to the fight for democracy playing out in Russia's backyard on the streets of Belarus. The former Soviet Republic has seen weeks of protests against strongman President Alexander Lukashenko since he claimed a landslide victory in last month's election, which is widely thought to have been rigged. Lukashenko has been in power for 26 years. He's known as Europe's last dictator. The protest movement has an unlikely hero, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, a stay-at-home mother who launched her campaign for president after her own husband, Sergei, was jailed and prevented from running. She tells me that she entered the race for love, but is now here to stay and fight for democracy. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, welcome to the program.
Hello, everyone. Thank you that you invited me.
You are in exile in neighboring Lithuania, presumably for your safety.
It's a pity that I couldn't feel safe in my own country, and I had to go to Lithuania. But I and my children, I feel safe here, and I can work from where I am.
You know, in a way, you are the accidental leader. You did it because your husband was in jail. He was going to be running for president.
It was my husband who wanted to take part in the election campaign, and he was the person who about 2 years was going around the country and interviewing people about their lives in Belarus, about what they would like to change, what they are unhappy with about our country. And he understood that people are so afraid to tell the truth. He understood that people's rights are not respected at all in our country. So he wanted to, to try to become president. But at the moment of registration, he was in jail, and I wanted to support him somehow. And I brought documents instead of him. So my first step was done absolutely for the sake of love, because I just wanted to support my husband. I never was involved in politics. I just was wife and mother. I saw the intention of Belarusians to fight for their rights. They wanted changes. They wanted new country. They didn't trust this president anymore. They wanted to build new free and safe country together with Sergei and together with me. And, you know, this way was extremely difficult. And I was afraid every single day.
Svetlana, I wonder whether you consider what Lukashenko must be thinking, because they obviously allowed you to register. They obviously did not think that you would become this figure.
I'm sure they registered me just to make love at me, because they understood that I am not my husband, and nobody knew me, and nobody would vote for me. But people understood that I'm my husband's wife. And if I made this step, that just for love, you know, that in our family, one for everybody and everybody is for one. So they supported me. And it was, I think it was like a shock for authorities. So they just had to leave me to show that there is a hint of democracy in these elections. So they, at that moment, that... Mm-hmm. They left the weakest person, as they thought.
Look, Lukashenko said after the election, you're talking about unfair elections and want to have fair elections. I am answering your question. We held elections. Until you kill me, there will be no other elections. That is pretty defiant, even though every weekend, 100,000 people at least have come out onto the streets against him. What do you think is going to happen?
You know, Belarusian people made their choice, and they will not be able to live with this president anymore. They don't trust him. They don't believe him. And afterwards, after all this violence he committed towards usual people, they will never be able to forgive him. So we are going to go out for demonstrations. People will strike. People will fulfill any other protest just to show that we are against this one person. We don't want him anymore. We don't want to live with him anymore. And this is deep political crisis in our country, and it's going to be a deep economical crisis in our country if they will not start this dialogue. The situation can change any moment.
What about the fear of Vladimir Putin's Russia? You know that Lukashenko has asked him for help. We understand that he's already sent in Russian state media to take the place of some of the Belarusian state media who've walked out on strike. And he's also said that he has a special police force, if it's necessary, he said. What do you expect to happen? What do you expect Putin to do?
You know, all the leaders have to understand that what's going on in Belarus is just about Belarus. It's our inner political crisis. It's our protest only against one single person. And we don't want any external interference into our internal affair. And we asked all the leaders to respect the sovereignty of our country. And we hope that every leader has heard our people.
What do you expect the United States to do? You know, the Secretary of State made a pro forma demand for fairness in Belarus. But he was in your region not so long ago in Prague and never mentioned the word Belarus, even while protesters were on the streets. What do you expect from the United States of America?
You know, maybe he has reasons not to talk about the situation in Belarus, but I'm sure that the United States, as the oldest democracy in the world, really supports the Belarusian people in their fight for their rights. And I have met a couple of representatives from the United States, and they really do support us.
As you know, Alexei Navalny has been the longtime anti-corruption campaigner. He also, like your husband, had YouTube channels and did a huge amount of work on that issue. He has just been removed from his artificial coma in Germany. And, you know, people say, the German doctors, that he was poisoned by Novichok, the nerve agent. Are you worried that something like that could happen to you?
I feel rather safe here. But situation, of course, can change because, you know, I understand that there is nothing impossible in our life, but it doesn't mean that it can stop me.
What is it that caused the Belarusian people, after 26 years of Lukashenko, and in many instances kind of accommodating with him over 26 years, what happened all of a sudden that they had enough?
Okay, I have to admit that it happened not of a sudden. It took a rather long period of time, I think about 2 years. But there were some events that pushed Belarusian people to this state. COVID, one of the most important, because we saw the real attitude of the authorities to Belarusian people when the fact of virus was rejected at all, because authorities told that we are guilty ourselves, that we got ill, that there is no virus in our country at all, and the numbers of ill people, they were much lower than they were in reality. Moreover, the fact that after the elections, such violence was committed towards Belarusian people, it was so awful that it will never be able to be forgiven and forgotten by Belarusian people. And once more, I think, is that a new generation grew up. And Belarusian youth, they have opportunity to go abroad. And, our parents didn't have such opportunity. So we can see how people in other countries live. Our young people understand that our rights can and have to be respected. And the falsification of elections, of course, influenced people a lot. So they got what we have now. We want our rights to be respected. We want to build new country where people respect each other, where authorities respect each other, and where we can be involved into development of our country.
It's a fascinating story. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, thank you so much for joining us from Lithuania.
Thank you for inviting. Goodbye.
And from that one woman's fight for democracy, we turn now to another woman's fight for clean resources and a safe environment. Erin Brockovich showed the power of individual activism when she took on California's massive energy corporation over contaminated water some 25 years ago. And she was immortalized by none other than Julia Roberts in the 2000 blockbuster film simply called Erin Brockovich. Here's a clip.
These people don't dream about being rich. They dream about being able to watch their kids swim in a pool without worrying that they'll have to have a hysterectomy at the age of 20, like Rosa Diaz, a client of ours, or have their spine deteriorate like Stan Bloom, another client of ours. So before you come back here with another lame offer, I want you to think real hard about what your spine is worth, Mr. Walker, or what you might expect someone to pay you for your uterus, Ms. Sanchez.
That is in-your-face activism, and all this time later, it is hard to believe that access to clean water is still not guaranteed in the United States, and Brockovich is now calling on Americans themselves to stand up and join her fight. Her new book is called Superman is Not Coming. Erin Brockovich, welcome to the program. So it is extraordinary to see, you know, it's great to reacquaint ourselves with that clip and see at least the film version of yourself. You have done something extraordinary. And I just wonder what you feel, as I said, that all these decades later, it's still not a given. There are contaminated waters all over the United States.
You know, that's a great question. And I can't believe it's been 20 years since we addressed that issue. I think even I myself thought that that might have been a one-off situation. And to go back and know where I've been for 20 years and in and out of so many communities like that, and we're still talking about it, makes me frustrated. It makes me sad. And this is why we did the book, Superman's Not Coming, because communities oftentimes feel that they are underestimated, that they won't be heard, that they get pushed around on, you're not this or you're not that, therefore your voice doesn't count. And I think it's really important, as I've gone across the United States, that people learn their voice and start to speak up. And we work with them on how to have the tools to fight so that they can be heard. So it makes me sad and frustrated that this hasn't gotten better, it's gotten worse.
Well, you know, we just heard from Senator Chris Murphy talking about people. He hoped his book about gun violence would inspire people to join the fight against that. So I'm asking you, how do you get ordinary people to do this? Give me some of the examples that you've inspired, because you have. I mean, apparently, Erin Brockovich has become a verb, to Erin Brockovich.
Well, you know, that's good old gumption. And we definitely teach them about having the power of stick-to-itiveness. And there's several steps that we go through. They will often come to me when the issue has now hit home for them. And that's why I think we're seeing such an explosion, because these pollution issues are hitting home for everyone. And oftentimes I find that when they come to me, they're looking for some permission, if you will, that maybe they're on the right track and that they should speak out. They're definitely going to get that from me. And then when they get into their communities, what they need is support, because oftentimes the own community members, they're fearful. They worry about property values. They're like, oh my God, I can't believe somebody would do that to us and not say anything to us. And our children have been exposed. So we get in there with them and teach them different tools, fact versus fiction. We give them information on the facts. And when they are angry enough, they turn it into action. And often it's about protecting their children and their health. They will stay in it for the long game. They will learn about the chemical. They will educate their community. They're running for city council and they're finding that voice. I will tell you, 9 times out of 10, it's a mom. And they are really on the move right now. And so once they have the support of the community and they have their facts, you know, knowledge is power, and they know that their child has been harmed by some pollution or a deception or a misrun agency, they will spring into action.
Well, I mean, they have already. You talk about moms. Well, there's your story about the moms in Hannibal, Missouri, who protested about ammonia in the water. And you say in your book, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. You're quoting Margaret Mead, the great anthropologist. So tell me about how Hannibal, Missouri changed. And even there is an Erin Brockovich do-alike with your gumption in China.
There is. And, you know, if that all came from the movie and people find themselves and something that I did, I couldn't be happier. And we will be there to support them all the way. And like the moms in Hannibal, Missouri, they had lead levels in their water in some portions in the distribution system as high as Flint, Michigan, which we're all aware of. They had this issue because they were adding ammonia to the system, which creates a corrosive water system. And so all the iron, lead, and manganese was precipitating out into the distribution system, and the lead was being delivered to their tap. These moms weren't going to have this. They were aware of lead issues. Their children had been affected. They made it their job, their business, to understand what ammonia added to the system, the havoc that it wreaks on the distribution system, the infrastructure, lead, and more pollution problems. And they wanted to do more. They educated the town. One of them ran for office. She won at city council. They did a referendum. The town had knowledge. They voted no more ammonia. It became a law. And I am thrilled to say it was no big federal oversight that came down and did that for them. They did it, and they now have lead-free water.
Okay, so let me ask you finally in the final minute. Well, it is inspiring, but you know, politics and the weight of politics is against, we've seen EPA rules, all sorts of clean water and clean air rules, regulations rolled back under the Trump administration. I understand that you grew up in a Republican household, and you say in your book that environment should not be left or right, Democrat or Republican. It should not be political. And you remind everybody that it was Richard Nixon, a Republican president, who created the EPA. So when you think about all this grassroots activism, how do you think they're going to get the help that they need from the federal government, which is where they really need it from most, to really make big change as well?
Well, yes, that's somewhat true. We're definitely learning, hence Superman's not coming. They can get change at their own city council with permits. They can get state action, which oftentimes is missing. And the federal oversight, you know, I get into these communities and they are Republican and they are Democrat, and they still have a common interest in water and their health. And so I don't get involved politically, even though I'm from a Republican family and my dad ran the pipelines for Citigroup. I heard a message from my father, a man, no matter what side of the aisle you were on, this is all of our home. And we have acquired a fateful power to create great damage. So politics actually bog it down when I need both sides. This planet, this country needs both sides to come to the middle and address first that, yes, we have a problem. We have antiquated infrastructure. We have pollution issues. We can't keep ignoring it and kicking the can down the road politically, because I think that we are all seeing a moment and a crisis is here. And instead of waiting for it to happen, we need to take action as the people, no matter what side of the aisle you are on, to divert further damage and or a disaster.
Well, it's really great to have you talking about this. Your book is going to be very inspiring, as you are. Erin Brockovich, thank you very much. Superman's not coming. Now, Latinx voters will also shape the outcome of the presidential election, with some 32 million eligible to vote this year. Stand-up comedian and actor John Leguizamo has starred on Broadway and dozens of films, including box office hits Romeo and Juliet and Moulin Rouge. He's now a first-time director with Critical Thinking. It's the true story of a group of underprivileged Latinx and Black teens who made it to the National Chess Championship back in 1990. 1998. And he tells Ana Cabrera, education and knowledge matter then and now.
Thanks, Christian. And John Leguizamo, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. What a blast. I have such huge respect for you and everything you do.
Right back at you. I'm excited to talk about your new movie, Critical Thinking.
We got a tournament coming up in a couple days. So we need to start really considering if we're serious about what we're doing here or not.
It's your directorial debut, which is super exciting, obviously. What was it like for you being in that position?
Oh my God, I had so much fun. I had such a great time. I didn't realize I had this whole catalog of directors' techniques to solve problems. I mean, I worked with some of the best. I've been in over 100 films, not all of them good, but I got to work with Spike Lee and Baz Luhrmann and Brian De Palma. And I have Ava DuVernay, and I have all this information that I was able to use in the movie. And I felt like, oh, wow, I do have a visual sense. I have a great way of talking to actors, and I understand storytelling. And I think I was able to take this movie to the next level. So I'm excited to continue in this path.
And you also play one of the main characters, a high school teacher who is so passionate. You really pour your soul into these children who are underserved, overlooked, Black and Latino students, and you help them on to the National Chess Championship. I have to ask, first of all, what drew you to this story? It's a true story. Are you like a big chess player yourself?
I mean, I play a little chess. You know, I knew a little bit. I used to go to Washington Square Park where the best players would be, and I would lose all the time. And you play for money, and I'd lose all my money, but it was all right. I learned a little bit. But the thing that really drew me was I knew what these kids went through. I knew what ghetto nerds feel, you know, ghetto intellectuals. There's no place for you. You know, and this teacher, Mario Martinez, created this safe space for kids who didn't want to go the wrong way, for kids that didn't want to play football, for kids who liked using their mind and were intellectual. He created this elective, this after-school elective where the kids could go and practice chess. And obviously, it turned out to be a great idea because they became United States chess national champs.
The movie is heartwarming and heartbreaking at the same time. When you say ghetto intellectuals, explain what you mean.
I mean, kids who are cerebral, kids who are gifted, kids who are super bright, who love to read. And these kids in 1998, their school, you know, didn't have enough supplies, didn't have the electives they needed. And this one teacher, Mario Martinez, believed in them. And he's I met the guy. He's an incredible nurturer. You know, he just loves these kids and felt what he needed to give them because they already had the talent. And the brains and the passion. They needed the book knowledge to cross them over from just being good chess players to become regional champs in every region in Miami, then state champs all over the Florida, and then, you know, national champs. And one of the guys, Marcel, almost won international world champion, but they disqualified him for some weird off technicality that he wasn't naturalized.
Wow. In the movie, you say chess is the great equalizer.
All right. Now, people, this is going to be very basic for some of you, but for the fish, or the newbies, as I like to call you, this is going to be eye-opening because what you've got is 64 squares, 32 pieces. It doesn't matter how rich or poor you are, what Ivy League school you may go or may not go to, what prison you hopefully never set foot in, because chess is the great equalizer. Okay, now in the opening, white always moves first. Now, I wonder what old white guy thought of that rule, right? I know you hear me.
I wonder, when you were doing research for this film, what did you learn and what do you hope the audience learns as they watch?
Well, you do feel like chess is a great equalizer because it doesn't matter where you come from or your ethnicity or background, or how rich you are or poor you are, it's about the game and your ability. And these kids proved it. And what I learned was, you know, chess is a very intellectual sport. You know, you got to be 5 to 10 moves ahead. Like in the movie, Marcel can play blind chess with up to 5 people. That means that he doesn't have to look at the board. You just call out the name of the space you're in and the piece, and he can do a move with five people at the same time without looking at the board. So it's all up here, you know, that the way they can see patterns in their heads.
You talked about how your own educational experience influenced how you went about this movie. And, you know, growing up myself in a Mexican-American family, I can think about how important education is to my family. And my, you know, my grandparents' families immigrated from Mexico, and they really saw education as the biggest key to assimilation and financial stability and their ability to build a better future for us. And I'm just curious what your experience was like with education growing up.
Well, you know, obviously my parents believe education is the key to everything. It's the most important thing, but you know, you can believe that, but if your schools are underfunded and you know, you have 45 kids to a class, it's going to be impossible to learn. And that's kind of the education I had. And the other problem is, you know, Latin people have the highest high school dropout rate in America. And I believe it's because these kids don't see themselves in their history textbooks, in the literature, in anything. I mean, and then when you find out that we're the ones who discovered this country and founded it and then handed it over to the British, and then some of it was taken from us, and that we've been, and we were there before that as indigenous people. We were Aztecs, Mayans, Incans, Toltecs, Zapotec, Apaches, Comanches, and 10,000 of us fought in the American Revolutionary War out of 80,000 troops. That means we were 1 in 8. And we had generals in the American Revolution, General Galvez, who had an army of 3,000 patriots who were Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, Cubans, freed slaves, and Native Americans. And they kicked the British out of the South so the British couldn't surround the patriots and crush them. So if I had seen that in my history textbook, if kids could see themselves as these heroes, then you can project yourself as a success. And other people then would have to respect you. You can't demonize Latin people if you include our contributions to the making of America.
Why do you think it has been, in your words, written out?
You know, if the hunter tells a tale, you're not going to know what the lion side. And I think it's definitely sort of a power grab. Latin people from 1830 to 1930, 1,000 were lynched and 5,000 were burned alive and shot as they tried to take away their land, try to take away their farms, try to take away their ranches and their homes. And they, and in 1930, during the Repatriation Act, they deported 500,000 Latin people that were American citizens. They were American citizens, and they took away everything they had and threw them out. I mean, it's crazy what they do to us. And if we're in history textbooks and in literature and in classes and celebrated as heroes and makers of this country, then you can do, you know, you can't do that to us. But without that, you know, they can demonize us and say we're not really American when we really are, more than most.
When I look at these students portrayed in your movie, I mean, they are facing all kinds of barriers. There's a language barrier, there's poverty, there's drugs and violence in their communities, in their homes. And unfortunately, that is a sad reality for too many children in this country. You do take a pot shot at public schools and funding in the movie.
We're here to raise $1,300 to offset our cheap public school system that's a little broke.
Oh, so you're funding this yourselves?
Like I said, we were hoping our Principal Kessel at Miami Jackson.
So much for a low profile.
We were hoping she was going to hook us up and get some school funding, but I don't know. She probably needs like a fresh new pair of rims or something.
Not a pot shot. I think I'm saying this is one of the problems in public schools. I'm all for public schools. Public schools are very necessary and very important, but they're not. I mean, Betsy DeVos defunded the public school system by $9 billion when she came in, and she's trying to voucher now so that you can create charter schools so all the great kids in certain neighborhoods can go. And then what happens to the rest of them? Are they just forgotten, left behind? I mean, that's not the key. The key is put more money. They just need money. That's the magic
serum, the magic.
So you think that is the solution? It's a financial problem above and
absolutely,
above everything.
Absolutely, absolutely. They've done lots of research, and they found out in New York City schools as well that all the better public schools, which are in white communities, get a lot more money than the public schools that are serving Latin and Black kids.
Why is that?
Because when white parents complain, you know, when they go to, you know, government officials and they write letters, they matter. When Latin and Black people do it, they're just kind of ignored.
What has been your experience in Hollywood being a Latino?
Well, you know, it's been pos and neg, you know, a little bit of both. I know when I started out with all my white friends, we were all in the same acting classes at NYU, and they were going to 5 auditions a day, and I was going to 1 every 5 months, and always for something incredibly negative and demeaning. That's why I started to write my own plays, because I was sick of having to play such a, you know, dark side of humanity just because I'm Latin, and that was not my experience of the people I saw. And in Hollywood, you know, I pitched this movie. It's impossible in Hollywood. I mean, we're 20% of the population if you include undocumented immigrants, and we're 25% of the U.S. box office, but less than 4% of the faces in front of the camera.
Why?
Well, I think it's because executives aren't us. The gatekeepers aren't Latin. If we need executives who are Latin and see the value of our stories, who appreciate us, because where there are no gatekeepers, we win. Like in music, J Balvin is the number one star on Spotify. He beat Drake. And why? Because you can measure that. We're Camila Cabello is top 10, Maluma's top 10, Bad Bunny, Cardi B. Why? Because you can measure those scans. And in baseball, we crush. Why? Because you have stats. In politics, AOC crushed because what? Because you can count those votes. And we flipped 4 big seats in New York City to Latinas. Why? Because you can measure that. But when it's a gatekeeper who we have to rely on his opinion or his taste, we lose because he doesn't see the value of our stories. They didn't see the value of critical thinking. They would tell me, John, Latin people don't want to see Latin people. I'm going, what?
Where are they getting that?
I was like, pull out your demographics, brother. Show me some stats.
Yeah.
There were none. It's just their wisdom. And Latin people don't want to see.
So it was an assumption.
Well, you know, they pass it off. I mean, he's an exec. So, I mean, you assume that it was research, but that can't be research.
I know for you in your show, Latin History for Morons, it's beyond entertainment. It's about education.
But yo, what happened in the 3,000 years between our great indigenous civilizations and us? How did we become so damn non-existent? Because if you don't see yourself represented outside of yourself, you just feel invisible.
And you wanted to take this show on the road, but because of coronavirus, everything's been sort of turned upside down. But I know you're trying to really get the Latino community engaged in their communities to prove to them they have that power. They have a voice and they need to use it. So what does this mean for your efforts?
Well, you know, you're right. Latin people, we're the largest voting bloc in America. 32 million registered voters. We are going to decide this election. And what we need to do is just reach out to them. I mean, when you reach out like AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did, she knocked on doors, she stomped, she made calls. My mom stomped with her in Queens. And Latin people, when you talk to us, we respond, we're loyal. But if you ignore us, we're going to ignore you. So that's what my advice to everybody is. And when I'm doing what I can, you know, I talk to Beto O'Rourke. I've talked to Julian Castro.
What about the Veronica current Escobar. President and the vice president who's running to defeat President Trump, Joe Biden? How have you had any interaction, or what's your take on how they're courting Latino voters?
Yeah, you know, he's been courting me through and all the other Latinos through all his surrogates. He's definitely seeking the Latin voice and how to win our vote. And now what I've been telling his campaign is, name Latin people to your cabinet. Put Julian Castro in your cabinet. Put Veronica Escobar in your cabinet. AOC, put us in your cabinet and show us that you are including us, you know, because we're 32 million voters. That's a huge block. We're going to decide this. You need to talk to us directly by including us and talking about our issues. And that's the only way we'll see that it's true.
And you're right. According to Pew, Hispanic voters will make up or have the potential to make up the largest non-white voting bloc for the first time ever. And in your mind, what's on the line in this upcoming election for Latino Americans?
I mean, a lot is at stake. I mean, this is the most important election in our lives in so many ways. I mean, it's a fight for our democracy against cronyism, against being ostracized. I mean, does Trump even have any Latin people in the cabinet?
He doesn't have a lot of diversity. You're right about that. He does. He'll point to Mercedes Schlapp as an example of of the people who's part of his administration.
I know we're 20% of the population. We should be 20% of his cabinet. I'm not asking for more. I don't want more. I just want parity. I just want equity. I want 20% of the roles in Hollywood. I want 20% of the children's picture books to be about Latin kids so they can see themselves. I want 20% of that cabinet. That's what I want. I want equity. I don't want more. I don't want to take anything from anybody. I just want what belongs to me and my people and people who look like me and children who look like me.
John Leguizamo, thank you.
Thank you. Much love.
A passionate reality check about a vitally important constituency. And that is it for now. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.